thank you for joining me, JM.
Yeah, of course. Happy to be with you.
So I know we wanted to, well, we're here to kind of talk about your comic book series, which is Swamp Dogs. And obviously I'm going to try my best to not give any spoilers away. I had the pleasure of reading the first issue, which, you know, offers a ton of promise, and there's a lot of kind of already within it potential, you know, mythos building and everything. But I'm not going to spoil anything. I can save that for you to decide what you want to spoil. But could you give us a little bit, I guess, about kind of your background and kind of how you led up to this? And then we can get right into kind of describing what you want to of Swamp Dogs.
Okay. Yeah. It's really tough to dance around something and not give too much away. Mm-hmm. Honestly, I don't think issue one gives too much away. There's a lot that happens, but from what I gather from the people that have like actually read it so far, but don't know the whole story, they're just, they're like, oh, well, there's a lot going on, but I don't know where it's going. So I guess I did pretty good about like teasing everything, or Theo and I, my co-writer and I, did a pretty good job about teasing without giving too much away. So my background is, this is my first comic book. It's my first real foray into fiction writing in the public eye. I've had one short story published before, and before that, all my writing history is working for infotainment websites like Screen Rant, doing listicles and news writing, a couple music reviews here and there, and that's about it. So, you know, it took me several decades to start putting faith in my own work. So I'm pushing 40, and this will be my first book.
Okay. And you know, the writing is up, and especially the artwork looks great, and I know we'll get kind of into that more so, obviously.
Sure.
But
yeah.
I guess before we do, could you give us a kind of a synopsis on kind of Swamp Dogs? I know we talked, you know, before recording about kind of the trajectory and the plan of kind of where this series is going and kind of, but yeah, again, I will not be the one to.
Okay. Yeah. I'll do what I can. Yeah. So, the elevator pitch that we gave to everybody, like on the creative team and all the variant cover artists that we pitched to and everything, was just, it's a young lesbian couple and a goofy stoner metal band versus voodoo powered Confederate undead. So, you know, the book that is being published right now is called Swamp Dogs House of Crows, and it's going to be a 5-issue miniseries that sort of introduces the world to the Swamp Dogs. The Swamp Dogs are a really sadistic, twisted group, squad of Confederate soldiers. You'll find out more about sort of why they are what they are later on, but basically, they are like a special forces in the Confederate Army with a special purpose, and they kind of go rogue and discover voodoo while going rogue, and they are resurrected in the present day and ready to unleash hell on Earth, more or less.
Oh, and that, yeah, sounds great. I'm always a big fan of that. And I know kind of beforehand, we were talking a little bit about, because you were talking about writing for the walking, or writing kind of lists and, you know, cover pieces on The Walking Dead because of the comic and the TV show. And we got into the whole discussion of kind of the, you know, the voodoo undead zombies and that whole,
yeah,
kind of snowball effect of where that thing can lead. But no, I, you know, it was really kind of pleasant to read for me, especially somebody who grew up loving zombies and the undead, and then was kind of burnt out by kind of the oversaturation, and then, you know, to kind of see, okay, so here are undead, but they aren't zombies, and they, you know, there are kind of all these different ways that you can take it that then make it fresh again.
Right, yeah. So, you know, we're not really shy about telling people what the swamp dogs are. The best way of taking them into consideration, they look like zombies. You've only seen the normal looking ones so far. You've only seen the zombie-ish looking ones so far. But as time goes on, they're going to get a lot weirder looking and a lot less zombie looking. And visually, what I tell people is to expect voodoo Cenobites is sort of the best way of looking at them. But the kind of monster that they are is actually liches, which role-playing nerds will kind of know right off the top of their head. But essentially what that means is like power-infused undead that have agency. Like they're not reliant on feeding on flesh. They are just sort of like magically sustained, and they are just as smart as they were in life, possibly even smarter, just as mobile as they were, possibly even more so, and just as mean. So these aren't, you know, lumbering, slow, where we're going to bite you undead. These are undead maniacs that are just completely unhinged from whatever moral constraints they had as living beings, as we'll find out in issue 3, which is a flashback issue, they didn't really have all that many morals to begin with.
Okay. Yeah, I'm really interested to see kind of where it all takes. I know even as we've kind of been discussing within these 5 issues, then you're going to explore it in, as you were talking about, other miniseries, one-offs. And...
Yeah. So currently the plan is, as long as people like it as much as I'm into it and Theo is into it, we're planning on doing 2 ongoing series after this. One we're going to be calling Pets Unleashed. I can't spoil anything as far as that goes. And then the other one will be called War Pigs. We just did an interview for Horror Geek Life in which we kind of talk a little bit about it. But basically, the first ongoing series to come out of it is... let me go back. The 5-issue miniseries House of Crows... The best way to look at it is as a horror movie, like a 5-issue horror movie. You know, it's got the same sort of beats as a horror movie. You're going to have sort of a satisfactory conclusion to it all. But it's clear from the ending that it's not the end of the story. Okay. And Pets Unleashed will take place in the near future after that and set up not just that the swamp dogs, you know, are like a new force in the world, but also that there are other events that come out of that that essentially end the world. And the second ongoing series, War Pigs, which I'm really kind of hoping to be publishing both at the same time, War Pigs is post-apocalyptic, and it's what happens to the world after it ends, in the second arc, and how things continue from there.
Oh, that sounds very interesting, and trying to kind of go off in a ton of directions, especially based on kind of reading this, you know, the one issue I had the pleasure of reading, that kind of, it makes me curious about how you're going to get to that point. But I actually was curious, as somebody who is a huge comic book fan, but primarily focuses on movies or screenwriting or stuff like that, that I know there was kind of this shift in the comic book world. If, you know, we're kind of moving away, but we're still within the writing process, there's a shift in the comic book world where there was like, okay, well, you had people going, make it more the scripting and the storytelling of a comic book worked more like that of a film almost.
Right.
So what was kind of the writing process and what was that like, especially, writing will just kind of deal with this first five issue part.
Okay. Well, you know, I touched on this in some previous interviews, but, this idea really came out of the idea of recontextualizing an actual movie and pitching it as a movie. So the groundwork started out as just taking an early 1970s film called Tombs of the Blind Dead, which is a Spanish horror film, and changing the setting and changing the characters, but essentially keeping everything else the same. And so instead of Templars from the Crusades discovering black magic in the Near East, it was Confederate soldiers discovering voodoo in the swamps. And instead of it taking place in, I think it's Portugal where it takes place, it would have taken place in Louisiana just post Hurricane Katrina. So the idea was always, in the beginning, to make it a movie, and it was being pitched to movie producers. And, you know, more or less having the same exact thing and just relying on the update to the setting and the explanation sort of be the hook. So when we decided that we wanted to go AWOL with it all and turn it into something much deeper and richer and more unique than just a movie adaptation, we still sort of kept the heart of setting up the introduction as a movie. And it was just going to be a movie, but as comic book issues.
Yeah.
And so, you know, we approached everything more or less like a movie script for the first five issues.
Okay.
You know, I don't know how other comic book writers do it because this is my first comic book, but, you know, when we're scripting it and we have panels in mind or specific images, we refer to everything in terms of like movie camera shots and stuff.
Okay.
You know, it's a zoom out and pan and, you know, all the terminology there. And then as far as the process goes, it was just sort of dividing up a traditional horror movie into five pieces and figuring out how that would fit.
Oh.
So we want it to read like a horror movie is watched.
Yeah. No, and you can definitely, you can really feel it because I mean, it, the way the panels go, the sequences, a lot of the picture flow feels in that vein.
Yeah. Thank you. Yeah, we try to keep it very cinematic.
Yeah, and it's a very quick read, which is, you know, it you know, as a compliment, it's a very quick, you know, it's not like a...
Right, yeah.
I don't know, Alan Moore or whatever, where you're saying they're, like, rereading the same panel a couple times.
Right.
Yeah, no.
It's we could have gone intellectual with it, and in a lot of ways we do, but we always, at the core of this, wanted it to be fun.
Yeah.
And so you're going to see that, especially in the future issues, where there is more dialogue and there are more characters talking and everything. The dialogue is really fun and bouncy, and the scenes that get set up are really interesting. But yeah, you're not going to have to reread panels two or three times to figure out what's going on. It's just going to be a lot of good, fun, breezy dialogue.
Yeah.
No, but issue one is kind of, I don't want to say wordless because it's not wordless, but, you know, the dialogue is economical.
Yeah. Yeah. It sets up a lot of it, sets up kind of the threat that is about to happen, and you are introduced to kind of our protagonists, and you're kind of given enough, I guess, like character elements, enough backstory to kind of then move along, you know, forward.
I actually just recently had one of my friends read issue one, and spoiler alert, there's a meet cute in issue one between two of our main female protagonists, Violet and Ayana, and he basically said that he felt as though, based on the way that we introduced Ayana in the beginning, that it felt like he was about to watch like a Skinamax movie.
Oh, yeah.
we do set this up with a character very, very quickly getting into a sexual situation. And so he's like, okay, so I was expecting some sort of corny, porny type dialogue stuff. And he said, you know, what we got was this element of wanting to have your cheesecake and eat it too, where we didn't want it to just be a corny thing. We wanted to establish a heart, and that these two women really are interested in one another and not just in a very base primal way.
Yeah.
And so he said that everything that comes from it could have been taken in a very lascivious, lewd kind of way, but there's enough heart in it where it doesn't play that way.
Yeah, no, I'd agree on that.
Thanks. that's what we were going for.
So, I guess with obviously, you know, making comic books again during this time, especially during the, you know, obviously a pandemic, mm-hmm. What has been that process, and I guess this process still moving forward of releasing it, and kind of what was the whole marketing plan or the distribution plan or anything like that?
Yeah, that it's a good question. I mean, in a weird way, I would say that the creative process of it hasn't been affected at all.
Okay.
We actually have never met, nobody in our creative team has met one another in person ever.
Oh, wow.
My co-writer Theo is in Greece. Our illustrator Cooper Ball is in Brazil. Our colorist Ruth Redmond is in Canada. Our letterer Steve Wands is on the opposite coast. I'm in LA, and Steve Wands is in New Jersey. And then our cover artist Robert Samelin is in Sweden. So it was always a digital collaboration from the beginning. And so, Theo and I have been going through this project for years. And, even with Cuber and Ruth and Steve and everybody, it's been quite a while. And so we're used to working digitally. We use Slack and Dropbox and Google Drive and sort of like every cloud service possible to make things work. So that part really hasn't been changed. Okay. Where I will say that things have gotten difficult and weird and strange is in the publishing side and the promotional side.
Okay.
I think that releasing my very first comic book during a pandemic has been really rough and difficult, and it would have been a lot more straightforward had I been able to meet with people in person. But the typical trajectory, I guess, would have been to sort of barnstorm comic book shops and get them interested in it. Scout Comics is, and Black Caravan, especially their horror imprint, are both relatively new and both up and coming. But it's a little bit spotty who knows about the publisher and who doesn't. Have been going around every comic book shop in LA, trying to work it out. And, you go into one shop and they're like, oh, we love Scout Comics. And, they're in our, staff picks and they're all over the shelves and everything else. And we have a huge crowd for it. And then you go into another shop and they've just never heard of the publisher, to begin with.
Yeah.
With the pandemic, it's made things a little bit more interesting, but it has also led to, I guess, some atypical ways of promoting. We did promotional bookmarks that we sent out to different comic book shops to sort of get fans into the idea. And this was the cover. It was just like a mystery campaign bookmark with the date for the Ashcan that we were releasing and then issue one. And what I did was I sent a bunch to friends in different big cities. And because of the pandemic, what I had to do was I had to call each comic book shop in each of those cities and basically say, like, hey, can we drop off bookmarks? Are you guys open to the public? If so, where do you want them? Will you come outside to pick them up? Because I didn't want to endanger friends and put them into a situation where they're like going into like an opium den of coughs and anti-mask rhetoric. So, calling the different shops, asking if they carry Scout, finding out if they'd be interested in our book has led to a lot of surprising opportunities and actually led to a couple different exclusive comic book covers that we wouldn't have had otherwise. So, it's been atypical, but it's been good that way. And then as far as the other promotion goes, it's comic book conventions have been weird and different. We would have been in San Diego this year promoting this book with Scout had the pandemic not been surging at the time.
Yeah.
And had San Diego Comic Con not been made digital. So instead, Black Caravan took it on themselves to do a sort of like a 3-day digital event through Facebook. And so I did like a little video interview then to talk about the book, whereas I probably would have been getting on everybody's nerves in San Diego otherwise.
That is a lot of amazing information. I know, part of what we do here on this podcast too is, kind of talking about that process and really what it is like to, as a creator in this modern age. And I think, it's interesting to hear, and it's, but it's not, it shows that it can still be done. And what's neat too is that the fact of your team having never met in person and being kind of all over the world, that it kind of, shows the, one of the sometimes many, but sometimes few positive aspects of what the internet can bring besides just arguing.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah. I mean, outrage culture and, the rampant misinformation is all well and good and everything. But there are some magical components to the internet, definitely. I was always kind of inspired by the musical group, the Postal Service.
Yeah.
Because, that was a digital-only collaboration. It was just Ben and Jimmy trading information, without actually being in close proximity. So, I figure if a really, really good, fun album can come of it, then a pretty good, fun comic book could come out of it, too. Yeah.
And so, going more, into the process a little bit. So,
sure.
For both of you while writing, is it one thing where you just send, one of you handles kind of a script and then sends it and the other person tackles it? Or how kind of did that work, or in terms of collaboration duo?
It's actually, it probably would be a lot easier if we had a formal setup for it, but we don't. Both of us are trying to live our lives and have experienced various ups and downs and rough patches throughout all of this. And so we haven't had like a single unified way of handling each issue. It sort of goes on an issue by issue basis because of personal issues. In some instances, we decided to split scenes where one of us would handle the band and all their interactions, where the other would handle the young ladies and their interactions. In other instances, it was like, oh, you take the first half of the book, I'll take the second half of the book, or, you know, something to that effect. And in the issue of the flashback issue three, based on circumstances, I actually scripted the whole thing to begin with. Okay. And then Theo came in and scrapped a lot of it and basically came up with his own version. And then we went back and forth and beat each other over our digital heads and came up with some sort of a common ground on that one, where we were both sort of happy with it. So, you know, it's been different each time. Typically, I would say what works the best is when one of us takes half of the book and the other takes the other half, and we sort of join it in the middle. Okay. But in any instance, what winds up happening is the other person will go over Theo will go over what I wrote, and mm-hmm. I will go over what he wrote, and sort of smooth everything over and put our own personal spins on it. And then, you know, make certain comments, and then we go back and forth and figure out what works the best. And so even if it's something that I wrote, it'll have a little bit of him in it.
Yeah.
And vice versa.
Yeah, to make sure it kind of has one consistent voice throughout.
Exactly. Yeah. Yeah. And, you know, the way that we've traded off the dialogue is, you know, you will see a little bit more of my personality when the band is talking to one another versus when Ayana and Violet are speaking. That is typically more his voice than mine.
Okay. Well, that makes sense. Yeah, and that's really interesting to kind of hear through all that process. So I guess kind of, you know, since this is your first, you know, work with comic book, as you said, and know, in the kind of getting to your the creative aspect of writing, or, you know, fiction writing,
right?
Kind of, so has this experience really, was this experience been like, was this kind of like a trial by fire element, especially jumping into a comic book series, or was it something that you kind of, was it easier than, you know, if you were to go into, you know, prose or whatever other, you know, screenwriting, right, COVID, whatever other mediums there could be?
You know, it's been interesting. I wouldn't say it's been a trial by fire. Okay. And I wouldn't say that it's been easier than I thought it would be. It's more than anything, I think, sort of unlocked me as a writer. You know, I've always, well, I wouldn't say always, I've mostly wanted to be a writer. You know, mm-hmm. when I was a kid, I wanted to be a Ghostbuster. So I can't say always.
Yeah.
And when I was two, I think I wanted to be a taxi cab driver. But for the majority of my life, I've been wanting to be a writer. And definitely on the fiction side and the poetry side and all that good stuff. But there's been a lot of self-esteem issues involved with that. Whenever I'd receive praise for anything, I just kind of assumed it was because these people had an emotional stake in me and wanted to be nice. And so I could never really trust what it was that they were thinking. And so when I would submit things for publication and receive even one rejection or two rejections, it would just devastate me, and I wouldn't want to put anything out into the world after that. And so having this comic book and having not just Black Caravan be interested in it, but we had a previous comic book deal for this also that sort of fell through, really unlocked something within me where I realized that it's not just the people that want to make sure that I'm feeling good about myself, that are interested in what I'm writing and enjoying what I'm writing, and enjoying what my brain is cooking up, but other people have an interest too. So, you know, it hasn't been difficult, but it's been illuminating.
Okay. Yeah, and that makes a lot of sense. I know it's kind of one of those issues that isn't necessarily talked about all the time, especially like, I've gone through the same thing. I know others have where, as you know, during this creative process, especially starting out or whatever, you get to this point where if you have family or friends telling you it's great, then you almost, your brain wants to like counteract it, where it's like, well, as you were saying, of course you would say it, like, but
right,
like it, you know, it's unable to take that kind of compliment or whatever it may be.
Yeah, you know, it feels like a patronizing pat on the head.
Yeah.
And you're like, well, okay, but, you know, how does my stuff actually measure up? And so I forget who I was talking to about this, but, you know, it's become a very slow realization that there's actually something to it. You know, there are stores across the country that are not just interested in what Theo and I are putting out, but they're doing exclusive covers for us, which means that they're buying hundreds of copies, you know, just based on the strength of issue one alone and the concept, and paying extra for it so that they can commission a really cool artist to do their own special cover. They're like believing in us enough where they're going to be charging $10 to $20 a book. Oh, wow. for our stuff. And so that's really empowering. And, you know, these, like even you, like you read the first issue and you wanted to do a podcast about it. And it's like, oh, well, you know, Craig doesn't owe me anything. Mm-hmm. And, meanwhile, he wants to talk to me about it. So obviously he thinks there's something there. And so, you know, it's a positive reinforcement and it sort of snowballs. But yeah, I think with any, I'm a clinical depressive, so I wanted to say that any person that's worth their salt has a lot of doubt within themselves, and that's probably not true. There's probably people that you know feel very confident about everything that are also worthwhile, but for me, a lot of my writing comes from this sort of place of insecurity and place of weakness and place of being very in one's own head. And so it's, you know, I kind of forgot where I was going with this, but, you know, I think that seeing that positive reinforcement, you know, just means for me and what I would say for a lot of other writers, if we're getting into the process, is if you have an idea that's inside of your head that you think is good, chances are you're not the only other person that's going to think that it's good. And as long as you commit to it, then somebody else is going to dig it.
Oh, that's, yeah, great advice and a lot of great, you know, yeah. It's things that I think, you know, that people may even know or tell themselves, but it's always nice to hear, especially what.
Yeah. And, I wish somebody else told me that years ago.
Yeah. Right there with you. But no, as I said before, I think this is a, you know, from what I read, it's an entertaining first issue that just flies by and offers a ton of promise, as kind of already talked about. But yeah, I don't know if there's a kind of last minute stuff you want out, but one of the kind of final things we will do during these interviews is a lot of, you know, we of course love supporting obscure or independent or obscure horror films or independent artists. And so if you have one, what is kind of an obscure horror film or comic book or whatever it may be that you believe deserves more eyes and that people should kind of, that you really champion?
Oh my God. I almost feel like that's the wrong question.
Yeah.
just because I could go on forever. I will say, miss a little bit of a personal plug. I haven't done reviews in a while because I've been busy with Swamp Dogs, but I do maintain a Letterboxd profile, and you can see ratings and movie reviews there for a bunch of horror stuff that I see and watch. So if I don't name check the movie, you can always see there, you know, what it is that I'm recommending. But I want to say that the most recent movie that I watched that has been really good, and I actually haven't finished it quite yet, is a movie called Block Island Sound.
Okay.
It's available on Netflix, and it's so far, I'm about halfway in, got a very cool Lovecrafty kind of vibe to it. There's a lot of mystery. It's really well put together, and it doesn't feature anybody that I've ever seen in another movie before.
Oh, wow.
So I would recommend that. As far as comic books go, I don't know that I've been reading anything super obscure. I have been getting to know a lot of my Scout and Black Caravan label mates, and I just read through Tales Told in Techno-Horror. I think I got that title correct. And that's Christian Dabari on art, who is actually, and this is a Bloodhound Picks exclusive, but Christian Dabari will be doing our 1 in 10 cover for issue 2. So, you know, we've been working with him. Him and... His full name is escaping me, but first name Kiarn is the writer, and it's a really cool little horror anthology that they've been putting out, and I would say that's definitely worth a look. And then I just also read Enzo Garza's Gut Ghost, which is a lot of fun and very much worth checking out. So, yeah, you know, Scout and Black Caravan have a lot to offer. There's a lot of other stuff that I'm reading right now from other publishers that's also worth a mention. But, you know, I don't want to spend an hour talking about everybody.
Yeah, of course not. But no, those are some great recommendations, and we'll definitely check them out. And, you know, of course, ask others too as well. And so how can people find you? How can they follow up with you personally, or even with the comics progress, or anything else?
Right. So we do have a comic specific Instagram account called @SwampDogsComic, and that is how you're going to see all the covers that come out, any sort of press or promotion. When this podcast goes live, we're going to post it there. Then I'm available on Instagram at j.m.brandt, B-R-A-N-D-T. I'm on Twitter at Mr. J.M. Brandt, so that's M-R-J-M-B-R-A-N-D-T. I am on Facebook. I'm sort of wherever the wind takes me. And then all of us have our own social media accounts, too. You can actually find everybody's handle, now that I'm thinking about it, at our website, which is swampdogscomic.com.
Okay.
And that'll also provide a link to pre-order issue 1. And right now we're selling our very limited copies of our Ashcan through the website also. So that's limited to 2,500 copies, and it is the first appearance of, you know, most of our main characters in the book.
Okay. Oh, that's great. Yeah, I know it's been such a pleasure being able to talk to you about this comic that I think is, again, a lot of fun, and just talking about the process and kind of what it is like in kind of doing it during this time. And I think, yeah, you offer a ton of great advice, and oh, it's just a pleasure to have you.
Oh, thank you. It was fun talking.
Pigs Podcast is part of the Morbidly Beautiful Podcast Network, produced by Josh Lee, Craig Drom, and Kyle Hintz. Music by Raymond Seed. Editing by Kyle Hintz.